Proceed. Mr. Kirvin, I'll not have you read this report, but give it myself. Do you remember that we had always seen that religion was a process of instating man into his real home, that by invocation of the name of God, men could outrun, outstrap, outstrip, defy all accidental spheres in which he moved. If we now place today, for simplicity's sake, men inside these spheres, we had distinguished, as you remember, the organic sphere, that we live in a rhythm of breathing and digesting and metabolism, which connects us with the air around us and the elements. We have then seen that we are tied by our will, by our purpose, to our work. And in this work we operate dead matter, which is not organically with us, but which has to be brought back into the life process. Otherwise, we would starve and would be killed by this dead matter. It would threaten us. It would poison us. So then we moved in the sphere of free association, of friendship, of love, of passion, of affection, of hatred and inclination. And we finally worked and lived under the impact of tremendous catastrophes which befell the whole group or the whole planet, like an earthquake or the famine and the flood. And we saw that the first religion, the first process by which men got a proper perspective to himself inside this living universe, was the concern with other life, the ritual of the animistic situation, as reflected in our communion supper, is that the divine life is everywhere, and that life needs life to exist and has to destroy life, and therefore we have to be very careful to, in our meals, to emphasize that really higher life only is allowed to take lower life. You remember I told you that meat in any animistic tribe can only be eaten by the whole group because they live in a higher spirit than the mere individual, which would only be allowed to live on nuts or fruits or berries or something, because you as alone are not spirited. As you judge yourself today, the modern man is quite logically a Christian scientist and a vegetarian, because he cannot use these higher things. The dismissed individual in this moment in the world, you see, who thinks of himself as just being A or B or X is quite right. If he says, I can't use a doctor with all his drugs and surgical operations, which is taking life from others, you see, so to speak, if you take all the drugs we use and all the serums and all the vivisection that goes into our surgery, you see, in order that you might be operated upon, so many guinea pigs have been slaughtered. So it's quite logical that a man who thinks of himself, I think wrongly, that he is just one man, you see, then he's just like an animal, and he has no reason to take any other animated life, because you are just as low as any other animal. It takes a value judgment and takes a firm belief that God made you into more than an animal to be able to take an animal's life. That's why you find in this country all the heresies today, you see, which animism already overcame. Animism is then the form, gentlemen, in which men became able to live among other lives on this earth by making sure that he would aim at a higher concentration of life inside his own group, by common purpose, and by being that being, we have talked about this, I am only recapitulating now, by representing the continuity of life on this earth, one man through all the ages, and one man over the whole earth, is more life than 10 lions and 20 elephants. But you alone are less than one elephant and one lion, obviously, and you have no right to kill it. It's very doubtful. If you take the Christian message, take the other cheek, turn the other cheek, well, please, why not apply to the elephant? It's very hard for you to define why God didn't create the elephant with as much right to exist as he created you. Once you make this abstract and fantastic statement, which every Dartmouth student at this moment is allowed to make, formerly the people would be burned at stake if they held to such heresy, you see. But today you can afford to say, I'm just a human being, by which you imply that any animal, any being is just as much one as you are. Now, obviously, gentlemen, we are not this way. Neither you nor I have any proper belonging. You are your father's son and your father's child's father, and you are a citizen of the United States of America. And therefore, you are representative of the whole human race through all times and through all ages. And for this reason, you may kill a lion, or you may kill an elephant. But these rich people from Chicago who now hunt these the African last wild animals from a car shooting them down, they just should all be executed instead of getting press releases. And who was this rascal who was nearly killed in the process? Well, one of them, not Hemingway, but somebody like Hemingway.
Brewer?
Eh? No, in Africa, a year ago, it was in all the papers. Of course, it was a big new publicity stunt. Don't you remember?
Johnson?
Me?
Johnson? Was it Johnson?
Eric Johnson? No. No, it was not. It was a writer. Wasn't it Hemingway? It was Hemingway. Well, I'm sorry for him. Pretty awful, these proceedings in Africa. You know, they have these lanes into which they drive the wild animals, and you sit in your sit in your car and bang, 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 bang. Well, I lived in Egypt one winter, and on comes a tycoon from Chicago with his wife in an airplane down on the Nile in Luxor, just fresh from Chicago. Obviously, he had still the bang, bang from the Chicago gangsters in his ears. Because the next morning, he hadn't even realized that he was in Egypt. Oh, where are we, and what's this, and so on. Come here, you see, in the airplane, you don't see much. On he went to the Nairobi for hunting the elephant and the tiger. And you really had the impression that now he was Al Capone, you see, and he shot the elephant, and in Chicago he would be the elephant, and Al Capone would have shot at him. But not much difference, you see. Wolf, 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 everybody. He had no right to hunt the elephant. Hunting is a very doubtful performance, gentlemen, at this moment for the individual American. You know, it's a great intoxication in Vermont and New Hampshire. And as far as we have too much deer, it may be justified. But if I look at these 5,000 cars which moved over the Plattsburgh Bridge on December 1st, I think it was, or whenever the hunting went up, pretty horrid, sir. All preparing for murder. Because, gentlemen, hunting is connected with religion. When the religion goes, you can't have the hunting. Because it is a decision on your part that you're quite sure that your life is higher than the animal life. And this life is not higher by yourself. You are not a good citizen and not a good churchgoer and not a good professional and not any good for a family man. If you're just treating yourself in your psychology by going to the analyst as an individual, you have absolutely no right to take anybody else's life. It's obvious that you have. It is only because the greater purpose of the human race to connect all times and all spaces is what justifies your and my interference with the rest of life on Earth. And therefore you see in animism this tremendous reverence for any life taken. I've given you many ceremonies in which this is expressed, leaving the tithe hanging on the tree, I mean, not harvesting all the fruit, replacing the skull and the skin, devoting the fat, dedicating it to the gods, and not eating it yourself, you see, because you had to be sure that bears would be there again, you see, and lions would be there, would be replaced. So no exploitation, gentlemen, and not throwing away your farm in the middle of the Middle West like a dry parchment and then going on to California.
Don't they have the same hunting laws, and you're not allowed to shoot a doe?
What?
You're not allowed to shoot a doe with deer.
Pardon me?
You're not allowed to shoot a female deer.
Would you speak so that I can understand?
You're not allowed to shoot the female deer. Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah, sure. Oh, we have, of course, the laws. I'm afraid you don't know how many does are actually shot. They always say they thought it was a buck. See? I mean, I know a little bit of my, about my neighbors. I mean, the law is all right. I mean, the deer, I don't think that I'm a sentimentalist. Deer has to be extinguished. I mean, it's otherwise a great nuisance, you see. You cannot, you have to keep it in bounds. But it is within the process of their reintegration. If you think how many species of animals in this country have been absolutely annihilated, it is terrible. Obviously, this is beyond the what should have been done. Isn't that true? I think we have, I bring this back to you, I think we have dwelled on this. I'm going to take now the next step, gentlemen. Man has not been satisfied with keeping alive among lives. That's the essence of animism, gentlemen. And you must see the profound and eternal problem in our butchery in Chicago, or in Armour and Swift's stockyards. That problem isn't yet solved. We have not solved the balance between life taken and the life given, you see. The whole problem of conservation in this country is the problem of animism. Our woodlands are also life. Our redwoods, not only, not the show places like the Yellowstone Park, but as you know, if things had gone on in 1933 as they were seemed to go, there would have been agricultural area in these United States, you know, of what size in 1984. It isn't accidental that Mr. Orwell, who was it, Orson Welles, picked 1984, gentlemen. He picked it for the wrong reason. But agriculturally speaking, animistically speaking, and religiously speaking, this country was doomed in 1984 because our agriculturists and conservationists had figured out that the whole cultivable, tillable area of the United States in 1984 would be the size of what, you know? Would be reduced by such dust storms and soil erosion to the size of the state of Arkansas. That's the truth, gentlemen. This country has gone a long way in being godless. It is a godless country with regard to the creation, which also is God's work just as much as you and I. Imagine these wonderful United States reduced in area of cultivation to the size of the state of Arkansas. This was a prospect. It is your business to see that the cattle grazers do not still bring it about. They want to. They all try to overgraze, as you will. It is terrible. The situation in this country hasn't yet been stabilized. You believe, of course, now in the automaton of government of, and big business, gentlemen. It is, you haven't done anything about conservation, but you have to. And you have to do it yourself. I hope that some of you band together in small communities and just reconstitute the community in the land. That's the business of college students. Why don't we give you all this waste of time and this wonderful season of champagne and spirits? You do nothing about it. You just try to find a job. Is that the way to repay this wonderful country? You do nothing about it. Absolutely nothing. You can, you make 10 millions, then leave 9 millions to Dartmouth College. But that's not what you are asked to do. You are asked to do something yourself. And this would be the first thing. We conserve the life in this country. Well, as you know, your younger generation has begun to do it. These large families are just the one who first, which you see spread up, you see, against all the predictions of all the statisticians, all the psychologists, all the sociologists in this country. They are just defeating the predictions of these people. You see that we would be a country without life, vitality of old age, you see, and the Townsend Plan. It is wonderful to see these families of four, five, six. That's the beginning of a true religion or true worship of just life. People have been frightened by the one and two children family. No life around them. A one child family is no family. At least if it knows this, it can make up for it by substitution, by friendship. But you have to know that it isn't normal. And I haven't seen any one of these people who pose in our scientific world for great experts saying that they have been not only wrong accidentally, but fundamentally when they predicted that this country would have to go to the dogs of the old age and would be in 1954. They predicted this right here, that the people of above 45 would outnumber the people younger than 45. All their predictions, fortunately, came wrong because man wasn't so godless as they predicted him to be. So you live in an upsurge, gentlemen, of new life, but you must conceive what you really experience. Perhaps not yourself, but around you, there is a wave of a new understanding of what the old people's religion was, animism. This tremendous delicate balance between life taken and life given, life murdered and life reborn and created, you see. And I can't go into all of it because we want to take the next step. Men discover, gentlemen, that dead nature also was an instrument of the divinity, that God is not in the stars, in the moon and the sun. At the outset, I wish to stress, gentlemen, that all tribesmen, as we know them, the savages, so-called, don't care for the stars in the heavens. They don't look up. The gypsies to this day have no word for sky in their language. The first man was concerned with life on this earth, and death on this earth, of course, and birth on this earth, and marriage on this earth. But he had no relation to the dead world except by trying to assimilate it as a living. For example, they would think that a stone was as good as a plant, and a plant was as alive as an animal, and an animal was as much alive as a man. That's animism, you see. But their assumption was everything is alive. Everything is alive, which we have to care for, which we have to preserve. And so they looked into many things live, which we would consider today dead, like minerals or so. Or water, you wouldn't think that water is alive, but for a primitive tribesman, of course, water was very much alive, you see. Was nymphs and naiads and all kind of spirits, just like you and me. If you ever, any one of you been of you in the Alps or in the Wild Mountains or in the Rockies, above Timberline, and you know that water there implies life. It is tremendously impressive to find in a book. Going in a glacier. This bit of water is life and connects you with life, the rest is dead. I learned my lesson out in British Columbia. We were outside a region which was mapped or charted, and we had to discover our own brooks, our own watersheds, the whole orientation of the country. So water became terribly important. And you know, the pioneers of this country discovered America by the waterways. They went up the waterway, you see, to the watershed and down the other side, the Great Divide. Not only, but in every respect, Wind River and Sacramento and all these rivers were great highways. You see, the only highway known in the discovery of this continent. And therefore, water, for the animistic man, is life and belongs absolutely to the side of the animals and the plants. And I think it's very arbitrary for you and me to say that it isn't. If you read West Running Brook by Robert Frost, you will see that he has, and I think very earnestly and very successfully, made water a part of the animistic worship which you and I, as modern men, rational men, still deserve to cultivate. But nobody in this country seems to read his best poem. Who knows about West Running Brook? It's a great poem by Robert Frost. He's still alive. So don't think what I've tried to show you, gentlemen, is animism is nothing somewhere in the Amazonas region. It is nothing in New Guinea. It is here. And we have to talk about it because it has been here ruined, destroyed, this respect. Nobody knows what he says when he says today, our daily bread give us today, because the children see in every household that the bread is thrown away. So how can you praise our father? In our countries, you know where I come from, of course, it was the vilest sin to throw away a crumb of bread. That was just not done. I still can't do it without trembling, without feeling that this will be visited on me. You're, of course, far superior to me, and therefore you think that's a superstition. It is not a superstition, gentlemen, it's a ritual. It's that which religion needs to train a man into his right position. If you throw away bread, gentlemen, you certainly cannot pray our daily bread give us today. It's a contradiction in terms. This new approach, gentlemen, to dead Nietzsche is very hard for you to understand. But I'm very pleased to be helped in this by a student of my other course. I gave the other, in my Philosophy 9 course, we deal with industry. And I asked them to deal with the calendar of industry, the production, the way their people produce day and night in the factory. And to suggest whether this way of life for a factory worker who works from midnight to 6 o'clock in the morning or to 8 o'clock in the morning was agreeable to a decent way of life. And one of the boys, many of them, by the way, did something similar, burst first in a condemnation of this industrial calendar, which of course is not very difficult to state, but he tried to get into the opposite calendar, a calendar which would bind men to the movement of the stars in heaven. Now, as I, in this course, am trying to compare primitive religions and our own religion, and to awaken in you the sense that these other religions all have their lasting and eternal glory and right, that they are true religions, just not complete. I was faced with a difficult task. I have now to talk to you about the astronomical religions of the Mayas, of the Mexicans, of the Peruvians, and so on. On the one hand side, implying that, of course, they went wrong, and the other, I have to state to you that they were right. This boy, so to speak, helps me by blindly rushing for the natural religion of the calendar of these old people and defending it as the only true calendar, and even implying that the Jews and the Christians actually live by a calendar of these stars, he says. Albert Schweitzer has said that Nietzsche's Superman is achieved. Man has created the finest world imaginable in terms of progress towards technological utopia. But he opined, Schweitzer, that he had no idea in the world how to control or guide this Pygmalion of ours, and that we were destined to squeeze the life out of that part of man which is man, and that for a race of superhumans we would become a race of super-inhumans. What this means to mankind can be readily evidenced in an examination of the calendar of the seasons. This is the most real and vital part of man's environment. Mountains may fall and rivers may be diverted. There will always be days, nights, moons, and seasons. That man wishes to keep track of these occurrences is totally superfluous. They will be. This is order in the universe. What is man's relation to this calendar of nature? It is, I hold, a relationship of ritual, of placement. It is the architecture of his environment. This calendar joins men to past and future. It takes men into the womb of eternity and gives them a home in the endless list of events dependent upon and in context of four immutable seasons. The calendar gives direction to the whole of man. All of him is aware of and in rhythm with this, with his world. The ritual of earlier men seemed more aware of this relationship than we. Older customs, and indeed the Jews have not forgotten, reminded men of his changing environment and gave him illimitable freedom through fulfillment of his dependency upon the seasons. Plant, grow, harvest, and plan. Be free by being in harmony with the rhythm of the seasons. The schedule of industrial production discards the natural ritual and for the immutable substitutes an artificial timetable. Well, you have here a panegyric, I mean a praise, of that calendar of which the pre-Columbian great civilizations of this country were imbued, with which they were imbued. What I want you to see and what is generally overlooked is this, gentlemen. Nearer to our skin is the animistic calendar. Life on this earth. Ancestors, children, animals, plants in this range, and I said, even on the farthest horizon, the mountain vivified and the stream vivified, you see, and populated by nymphs and naiads and how they called all these spirits. But now we come, gentlemen, to the most extreme environment. If you look up to the stars, you can't reach them. Animism deals with what is in reach. which can participate in your life, you see. But gentlemen, astronomy, cosmic religion, all cosmic religions, and all our part in cosmic religion, our worship of sun and moon, our respect to them, cannot reach them, you see. The stars cannot be touched. You have to let them alone, leave them alone. Now there is a constant mistake, and as in this voice paper here, between this wide away world and the divine. Because the sun and moon are far away, you think God dwells behind the moon. He doesn't. It's a common misunderstanding that, of course, that people, when they say our Father in heaven, think God is somewhere in the heaven and he is not on this earth. He's neither on earth nor in heaven, gentlemen, because in you and my heart, or he isn't. St. Augustine and Paul and Jesus had a hard time to state that God has nothing to do with space. Perhaps you take this first down as a warning, that the placing of God on some comet may be still a good policy with some Roman Catholic clients of the Pope, but the Pope himself does not believe this. He cannot, because St. Augustine and Jesus and Paul says that God is not in heaven in space, but in your heart. The kingdom of heaven is in our heart. This is so terrible because it makes a constant rift between our Roman Catholic friends and the others. I'm not a Roman Catholic, as you know, but I have all my friends in the Roman Catholic faith, and they are not superstitious. But they never dare to stand up and say frankly that it is a superstition to say that God is somewhere in heaven in a local sense. We have the word heaven and not sky. God is not in the sky. That's the reason why we have to say heaven and not sky. And I know, of course, that the real faithful and religious Catholics have a terrible fear to tell their Irish companions that they are mistaken, or their Polish, or their French Canadians, or whoever these are. The superstition is cultivated, that you can be a pious Christian and still believe that God is living on Venus. You cannot, gentlemen. That's anti-Christian, it's anti-Jewish, and it's anti-revelation. God is not in space. As long as you believe this, you have no idea what religion is. Because even the Egyptians and even the Mayas didn't believe this. They thought that God was in the movement of the stars, that the rhythm of the stars was divine. They have never worshipped the sun or the moon. Never believe this in your books. All the books written by modern liberal men who have no relation to religion whatsoever that say that men had a cult of the sun are all just wrong. For example, you can read in every textbook that the Egyptians worshipped the sun. They never did anything of the kind. They wrote the sun, gentlemen, with this sign, and that meant the day. And the day for a decent person is below dignity. They only begin to worship the year, this, and then they begin to worship eternity. That was a man shouting on the top of his lungs, millions of years. That's the first hieroglyph which expresses the real face of the Egyptians. That is, the sun, then the sign for the sun is something below the attention of men. The sun rises every day and goes down every day. You can't organize life around it. The great discovery of all of the Mayas is eternity. And the eternity has much as much to do with the night as with the day, as much with the disappearance of the sun, as with, you see, its appearance, as much with its becoming smaller as with its increase, so it cannot worship the sun. So gentlemen, throw this out. One of the liberal mortgages of American civilization is this idea that primitive people worship the sun and the moon. They never have. What they have tried to find is the harmony of the spheres. And you find this still in Plato. If you read the Timaeus or the Republic or the Laws of Plato, he tries to revive the Egyptian religion that there is, like the Pythagoreans, there is a harmony. And if you read the end of the Merchant of, who has read the Merchant of Venice? Well, do you remember? Such rhythm is in the immortal spheres, but we,
honestly,
they just cannot hear. Can you remember at the end of the fifth act?
I don't remember.
Well, it's a very wonderful piece of Or the, perhaps the, well, I won't say the greatest, you never know with Shakespeare. But the fifth act of Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice is his deepest religion. I mean, it's his greatest confession of religious faith. He's purely secular. He had everybody in England at that time, as you know, had burned his fingers in religious controversy. So in Shakespeare, you don't find a hymn, you don't find any religious positive statement. The curses, I think, is in this last act of the Merchant of Venice, which is a translation of the liturgy of the great Saturday between Good Friday and Easter Sunday in the Catholic Church, because Shakespeare obviously was very much a friend of Roman Catholicism. And so he has translated there in secular language the liturgy of the Great Saturday, the day on which Christ is in hell. And there he then speaks his deepest mind, so to speak, and speaks of this harmony of the celestial spheres, which we cannot, you see, our earthly, how does he say, our earthly, I don't know the verbatim, but some of you might be interested to know. There, if you want to find the heart of Shakespeare's religion, read the last act of The Merchant of Venice, the reconciliation of Christians and Jews, the, so to speak, the kingdom of heaven on this earth. Music, as you know, the great apology for the man who has not music in himself. But you know this? No? Well, that's a great line there, you see.
So it's hard to understand how the English could become so unmusical after that.
Not the sun and not the stars were worshipped in antiquity, gentlemen. And you come to America, and you see Middle America. Here I have a map of the Yucatan. You will perhaps know by now that the greatest if this is the Gulf of Mexico, gentlemen. You will have heard of the Maya culture, which would be like this here. And you would here have the Olmecs with their great three centers, Las Ventras and Piedras and what's this, Tres Zambotes. And here you would have Mexico City. And here you would have Chula, 100 miles south of Mexico. Who has been to Mexico?
Everyone? Have you been there? Where, how far did you go south? Did you go beyond Mexico City? Below?
I'm not exactly sure. Right.
This would be Yucatan. Have you been there?
No, we didn't go there.
Well, Cook didn't take you there, or did Bayhawks, I don't know. But this is the most interesting part of for such a trip. This here, Palenque and Topan, and Las Vetras, and... well, what do we find there, gentlemen? We find some very stunning things which we also find in Egypt and which we find in Babylonia. These are regions, gentlemen, which have practically no hard stone. And yet you find volcanic basalts or porphyry or sienite moved over 1,000 miles to a certain place to build a temple. Well, what is such a temple? Isn't that the first effort of men, gentlemen, who ceased to be animistically alone inclined and wanted to catch the whole cosmic order? Was, gentlemen, to touch what cannot be touched, eternity. And really, literally, they wanted to reach to the stars and wanted to incorporate, comprehend the full width of the universe, which we, under our electric illumination at night, rarely have any reason to contemplate You don't see the stars here in Dartmouth because the campus is far too much flooded. I hate these floodlights for our tower because they are just vanity. Our Christian churches are flooded at night when they are closed. It's very funny for a Protestant church to be flooded at night and to lure the people there, and when they go there, they can't even enter. It's all closed. The Catholic church is at least open at night, but when you drive now to New England, all these people advertise their church overnight and exclude God Almighty and his nightly galaxy and his nightly stars from your view. We live in a fantastic world. And therefore, I have to preach the gospel, gentlemen, of the cosmic religion of these people. It's a great religion because it tried to make men aware of what you are so proud of with Copernicus, of the wisdom of the world, and how little you and I are if you are not reinstating yourself as a star among stars. The great ambition, gentlemen, of these people of old has been to get to the furthest. Animism was an attempt to remain close to life, you see, in the center of your tribe, of your family group, and everything around you, the domestic animals, you see, the hut. Gentlemen, the great calendar religions of antiquity are attempts to give God the praise of his width, of his glory, of his amplitude, of his everywhereness. The first problem is of these people, or of the Mayas, or of, as I said, of any empire of old, is to build temples. And what is a temple, gentlemen? A temple is an attempt to bring heaven down to earth and to make sure that all the heavenly powers enter your and my life and help to regulate it, just as this man claims that the calendar of the seasons, if it would regulate your and my life, would make us a more dignified person than working on ships, in ships. The attempt to bring the furthest closest, and therefore, gentlemen, the obsession with eternity. It is, isn't that strange that there is a break in all the attempts of the animistic tribes, and to say we are not interested in us, we are not interested in our children, we are not interested in our grandfathers, we are interested in eternity. I try to tell you that the first hieroglyph, which we find in the first dynasty of Egypt, is a man shouting on the top of his lungs, eternity. That is a man, the human being, so to speak, who can say millions of years to the Egyptians amounted to the true human being. To give you an instance of what this means, gentlemen, all family men, you yourself, live at best within three generations. Most of you, of course, live only day by day. If you study the time horizon that influences your actions, it is the election, it is the stock exchange, it is the weather, it is the examination. So if you take it all together, the largest period for an American male is 4 years. You don't think any further. At the Hanover Inn, it was impossible to get a student to learn to cook, be the salad cook for 2 years, although they offered him $5,000, that was 10 years ago, then money went three times as much, free board and lodging, laundry free, and $5,000 in cash, if he would settle down and learn for 2 years how to cook, make the salads. And he said, what I cannot learn in 3 months, I will not learn. That's the American horizon of time. Your horizon of time has dwindled to much less than the savage. The savage has at least three generations. You live by 4 year standards. That's why you are always fooled with fortune, fate. I mean, take the Korean War, take the World War. You went home and said it's all over. Well, of course it wasn't, because such a war is upsetting and settling for 30 years. But you cannot think in terms of 30 years, you see. If I go to a reforestation meeting here or soil erosion meeting in my community, there is not one man who cares what happens to our community 10 years from now, let alone 30 years from now. Yet you can only fight soil erosion if you are interested in the future of my town, you see, 30 years from now. That's the first time that something will bear fruit, which we do now in this matter. And so you all, gentlemen, must be now administered by a benign tyrant in Washington, because he's the poor of Eisenhower administration, any administration was, with all this watery head bureaucracy, is the only element in America which is in a certain extent responsible for 2050. Not one other person in this country acts responsibly for this far future. The Russians too, you see, they undergo terrible hardships because they want their country to be strong in 2050. You won't. You want to have it now. 33 million television sets as of today. So absolutely nothing provided for the future. Nothing. Quite, you may be sure that the material of these 33 televisions, a million television sets, would have been badly needed for other things. So, gentlemen, you have no horizon of time. Therefore, it's very hard for you to understand the step from a man who lived in 3-4 generations, father, grandfather, in a tribe, you see, then to step out and speak of thousands of years. The Maya calendar counts back to 3,113 BC. The Egyptian great year enabled the Egyptians to live three times in phases of 1460 years. Perhaps you take these figures down, you don't find them in any other book, gentlemen. This is fantastic. The Egyptians have three times met, so to speak, eternity in 2780 BC, in 1319-20 BC, and in 139 of our era. They have celebrated the god of Eon, the god of the eons, the great year. In 1460 years, gentlemen, the calendar of the priest and the real astronomical calendar coincide again, because the Egyptian calendar knew only of 365 days for the year, and that, as you know, brings about a quarter of a day of error. We have now the leap year for this. The Egyptians didn't have it, and so you can easily figure one quarter of a day per year makes in 1460 years 365 days, you see, because 4 years make one whole day. And so 4 times 365 is 1460. And therefore, in 1460 years, the world was at the same place again on the firmament and on Earth. And they, so to speak, rectified their observations, you see, on their computations on that day. And the Egyptians have been able to foresee this as early as 2500 BC. And so we have the tradition that in 1320 and in 139 of our era, under Antoninus Pius, there was even a coin coined in honor of the return of the great year. And that is called an aeon. And as this word aeon is also used in the New Testament, when you pray, world without end, it literally says in the New Testament nothing of the kind. It says, aeon of the aeons. And this is just a pagan and unbelieving translation of the King James Version, world without end. It should be thrown out. It's a very distressing fact that this is just absolutely wrong, this wording of our prayer, world without end. Because it just means that the world does come to an end and begins again. The real belief of any Christian and any Jew is that the world has seen many ends and many beginnings, that there are eons. And if you say world without end, you just abolish the power of God to end and to begin. So there you see one of the roots of our evil. In the Renaissance, men had lost all understanding of a living universe, kept going by creative acts. And so since 1500, you get this misunderstanding that primitive people worshipped the God, the sun. Gentlemen, the primitive man was much more simply, he tried to find God through the movements of the stars. What else can we do? They are there. They move. They must have some meaning, you see. We aren't very much advanced. I don't see that we advanced. Nobody can ever explain, as long as you and I shall live, or any human being, why there are these millions of stars. These astronomers may investigate what they do and how they work, but he cannot explain why God went to this expense, so to speak, and luxurious dispensation of squandering millions of stars around us and making us see them, what does it suggest? What is there? Probably no life, just order, harmony, movement. Once you come to ponder about the existence of the stars, gentlemen, you suddenly know the cheapness of science. The astronomer knows absolutely nothing about what these stars mean with regard to you and me. He has nothing to say about that. He can compute them, as he can count the hairs on your head, gentlemen. But that's not very interesting for you and me. If somebody tells me that I'm bald, I have to live with my baldness. That's quite a different, that's a religious proposition. If somebody tells you why I'm bald, that doesn't help me at all. Or I have a hunchback. I have to live with a hunchback. The scientific explanation why I have a hunchback is of no interest to the men wearing the hunchback. So in the same way, gentlemen, these people discovered eternity. That is, they went beyond the life on this earth, the organic life, because they saw family died out. After a few generations, you see most families, leading families of chieftains and kings, as you know, royalty, they all die very early. And Gloria Vanderbilt will not have many children, she goes on play acting. So great families, gentlemen, all have a very short time span. As Hamlet says, the Yorick in Hamlet, the rich people, the great people had so much reason to commit suicide. And race suicide, gentlemen, is general, which means that men try to look something that was more universal, more lasting, in the sense more divine. And they worshipped this so much that they built temples out of basalt, out of gold, out of jade, out of smaragd and amethyst, of diamonds. And the whole cult of gold, gentlemen, which still is quite familiar in this country, the whole gold rush in Klondike and in Colorado and in California is the last remnant of this belief that gold on this earth is a reflection of the sun, of the cosmic, eternal, imperishable quality, you see, of the firmament. Earth and heaven were opposed for the first time when men went out for eternity. And so he hunted on this earth for all the imperishable. And it seemed that the most imperishable was gold. It doesn't change, you see. The whole kind of gold in this country, therefore, is the last remnant of the belief of the ancient empire builders that men should be out for the imperishable in the universe, not for the living, not for plants, not for animals, you see, but for sun and moon and their reflection on the earth for the metals, the minerals. For example, iron was worshipped before it was ever mined in the world as a meteor. It was called celestial stone. That's the first word for sideron, iron. If you know the word English, German, you know the word consideration in Latin, which means to consider the stars, because sidera, these are the stars in the heaven. Consideration is the same as the word contemplation, to look up to the heavens. Now, the word for iron is sideron, that is coming from the stars, only to show you that the people were interested in iron first as a testimonial of the life of the upper world, you see, because it fell down, the meteor, and it contains iron, as you know. The meteoric iron, called sidero, who knows Greek? Anybody still left? No, of course. I'm like a mammoth with my Greek knowledge. Completely died out. Is there any connections to the word sidero? I don't know. Perhaps in some geological phrase, maybe. But I think it's worth your while to note that the Greek word for iron still reminds us that it was meteoric iron, and that it impressed people then to find on earth the same heavenly metal, you see. So that the mining in Hungary and in the north shore, southern shore of the Black Sea, which are the oldest places for iron mining, were discovered because men knew what he wanted. He wanted to have the everlastingness of the heavens. And Iron was a messenger of this consideration, was a part of this consideration of men. To give you the words for the most important words for this astronomical bias, theory, of course, means to look up to the sky world. Contemplation means the same. Consideration. The word cosmology, of course, astronomy, astrology. So that you only see the range. The word calendar comes from here. You cannot imagine the break, profound enough, between the Maya people and the tribesmen that went before it. To organize the transportation of basalt stones over several hundreds of miles, you see, just to build a temple, implies a patience, an organization, you see, and a faith that had radically nothing to do with the faith of the people who lived in Arizona on the Mesa Verde, for example, you see, or these hut dwellers. The difference, gentlemen, in one word is these were house builders, not hut dwellers. The difference between hut and house is still in our language a little bit kept by, we speak of cave dwellers. But of course the cave dwellers had very many huts already, roofs, tents, you see. The difference between a hut and a house, gentlemen, religiously speaking, is that a house is oriented from the whole universe down to me, because it is oriented by north, south, east, and west. A house is always the dependency or the heir of religion. A hut is simply something for utilitarian purposes and has nothing to do with religion. Whether you live in a hut or in the open depends just on the weather. But whether you live in a house, sir, you see, or in the bush, that depends on your religion. Because if you believe in the regular movements of the sky, that was the great revelation of these Maya people, then you may be able to place yourself, to reinstate yourself by invocation of these new powers, of the star world, of the astronomical universe, to place yourself in one place so that you wouldn't have to move anymore, that the divine powers could be invited to your home. And the great difference, gentlemen, between the first religion and the second religion in the world has been between migration and settlement. Now the terrible thing in your books, or by Mr. What's the most famous textbook on prehistory which you all have to read? List, what's the man's name with Arab? Oh, you all have this book. Very poor. You see, they all cannot distinguish these two layers as having implied two different religions. They think that men gradually settled. That's impossible. The settlement of man was such an unsettling thing for his mind because it suddenly limits him. Now, gentlemen, if a man suddenly tells you that you cannot walk any longer, you have always to take a car, you see, that would be by and large the American break of the last 20 years, you see, that you actually believe you should drive by car from the dormitory to the club, to class, which is your religion. But you can still think of some people who are not declared to be insane who do walk from the dormitory to class. Perhaps some of you even do that. So you are still Stone Age Indians, you see, by walking. The same break which comes between an owner of a Ford or three cars in one garage and a primitive man who in Europe who still has a bicycle or legs to use. That's the same as between a Maya man and a Peruvian man and an Aztec and the primitive people who populate to this moment from the North Pole to the South Pole, the American hemisphere. They are divided by a different religion, separated by a different religion. The animist wants to keep in touch with the nearest, and he wants to find life wherever he can find it. He hunts it, he collects it, he moves, you see. Life comes to life. It's the essence of life that it moves. But if you're out for gold and for stones, gentlemen, and for minerals, You emit yourself, you apply yourself to the things that don't move, that live by gravity, that stand still, and you build a temple. And the terrible confusion, I think, in modern prehistorians and anthropologists' mind, Mrs. Margaret Mead and all these people, is that they have never seen the religious break, the religious effort that is needed to give up the privilege of men to move and to tell an Egyptian or an American that he has to stay in his country and that Mrs. What's-her-name is not going to give you a passport. If you would be told today, 160 million Americans, that they can no longer leave the country without an investigation by the McCarthy Committee, perhaps some of you would wake up to the fact that we are now at this moment entering the days of Egyptian darkness in this country. And we are. Because it is for you in this economy with its high standard of living and its prosperity that has become quite normal to think that you have the right to exclude any newcomer from this country if it endangers your prosperity. You think that's justified? You think that this damn McCown law is not a crying injustice and it is not sawing off the basis of the United States faith and religion? But it is. Because it means exactly as in the old days that you can divert the rays of the sun and the moon, which makes the thing go after all in this country, to this country, that you can build your skyscrapers, that you can draw the line, who comes into Ellis Island or some other detention place of detention, and who cannot. And that you really think is justified. And I can have, out of 99 believe that this is so. Well, they are all Egyptians. They all have sent down into what the Jews called Egyptian darkness, which anyone has a certain mind here. Under the Egyptian darkness, you can have prosperity. Under the Egyptian darkness, you can have settlement. Under the Egyptian darkness, you can have the highway system of America. And everything it implies. Because you move inside a given area which you have declared to be cut out from the rest of the world as a separate entity. Which is exactly what these people did. You see, concentrating the rays of all the stars, and that is the meaning of a temple. A temple is the selection of a privileged piece of earth to reflect all the cosmic powers in the heavens. It is all a telescope in reverse. All heaven shines on this piece of temple. When we have a telescope, we can use it to look at all the heavens, you see. Now, how would we call a telescope in reverse? You must think that all these people were certain that by discovering the secrets of the 1460 years and of the 3,113 years as the Mayas did, they were in the know of the secrets of the heavens, and that therefore they could direct all the cosmic forces upon their little island. Because these little empires, you see, didn't amount to much more than an island. It has even been said that in this Olmi culture here, Ventra was perhaps the last, it was perhaps an island, where we have found these majestic four giant heads. They are 5 meters high, that is 15 feet each. And out of basalt, out of a stone, nowhere found here for 300 miles. So these people must have the idea that they were able to direct the cosmic rays, so to speak, and the divine favor, you see, on this one spot. And that's a house of the gods. The first house on earth, gentlemen, was a house down from the sky. Many words have been tried in the last centuries, in the last century, or I should say, over 60 years, to tell you what a temple is. A temple literally means to cut out on earth something that reflects the whole sky. The word templum comes from cutting. Cutting out, temna in Greek means to cut. And you cut out a square on earth which has the proper quality so that all heaven can be mirrored in it. So a temple is a place on earth, gentlemen, in which the whole sky is present. That's perhaps the most general translation of the temple. And again, I want to tell you, gentlemen, that you believe of your own country, the United States, of the New World, that it is such a favorite. It's God's country. As if then the farmers say we must celebrate Thanksgiving when it comes and not when Roosevelt says, they meant exactly this, that the calendar of this country had some divine inspiration. Thanksgiving was not accidental. You couldn't change it. It was just there. That's God's Thanksgiving. It is in every human. So please don't despise this calendar. What I say, my difficulty is in warning you against it and in filling you with awe for it. An element of this calendar must be in all of us. We must comply with the divine, with the celestial order. What I must, however, in the same breath, so to speak, tell you is that this is only one step. It's a step into the inorganic matter on which we depend. The dead matter of the universe. The stars are dead matter, not living substance. They don't speak to us, gentlemen. But they move, they keep us in suspense, they attract us, they let the light in and takes and brings the cold in, heat and warmth, light, day and night, they come from there. They are important enough to make us wonder. Because without light, of course, and rhythm, we would not be able to think or to organize or to do anything. So have I perhaps succeeded to convey to you that this is a tremendous thing, the discovery of the outer ring of our existence? You can imagine that this religion can have many variations. You can concentrate on the galaxy. You can concentrate on the sun. You can concentrate on the moon. You can concentrate on the planets. You can concentrate on the ellipses. You can concentrate on the meteors and the comets. Accordingly, you will have different religions. You can stress the irregularities in the sky, the sudden misfortunes that befall even the sky world. You see a new nebula or an explosion. And you can stress the absolute regularity. You can see that even this religion, as animism, it can have many variations. You can worship the eagle in animism or the raven. That's up to you, you see. In the astronomical world, you find great distinctions whether they stress the regularity or the irregularity. For example, the planets are of very late discovery and very partial interest. The Egyptians had no interest in the planets until 300 or 500 BC. Then they became all important, and you still live by the planetary week, as you know. You still worship Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, which are the planets, in addition then the sun and the moon. Monday, moon, Sunday, sun, and then you get Jupiter, Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturnus. But that's late, because it's already stressing the irregular stars. That's a very late discovery. The first interest of the two religious of the four great new governments in America as well as in Asia was concentrating on the regular. The other way of connecting with the past, and although the dead are still within this past, kept alive, it's not the only way by which the past is kept alive. It's still there. It's never vanishing. It's, in the literal sense, you see, imperishable. That's why gold and stone had this tremendous emancipatory significance, just as you don't know who your great-grandfather was, very many of you, but you do think that the Statue of Liberty is there for good. In the same sense, the Statue of Liberty replaces all the private ancestors, you see, whom you do know so well. If you think how much you know of your great-grandfather, really, and how much you know of the Declaration of Independence, you see that the Declaration of Independence is much more vital in your life than what your great-grandfather did or thought. Is that true? Or would anybody pretend that a great-grandfather is more important than the Declaration of Independence? That would be interesting. To me it isn't. My grandfather is still very important to me. I know a lot of him. I know next to nothing about my great-grandfather. I know something of him, about him quite something as an anecdote, but that's all. He was pressed by French soldiers when they retreated from Russia to to bring a message to their headquarters. And he didn't want to serve, he was a Prussian, he didn't want to serve the enemy, so when they had left him, he burned the message and didn't sort of consider himself quite a hero. That's all I know of him. And literally, that's all I know of the man. Is that interesting? Of course, that was the one story that deserved to be told in the family. Well, if you come to think of this gentleman, you have for yourselves a clear indication that you don't live by the animistic calendar. Life is not known to you, the past is not known to you through the life that has existed before, but through other means. Buildings, statues, monuments, documents, you see, which is something quite different. Books. The temple, gentlemen, must be oriented. That is, it must contain access to the whole skull. The word orientation, of course, means only to consider the Orient, and that's the East. And we have, unfortunately, in our language, no word that coincides with consideration or contemplation. You see, we have made out of contemplation when you just barely do not give to sleep, and consideration, you see, if you just barely do not tread on somebody else's toes. But that's not the meaning of these words, you see. The meaning of these words is that you let the stars in consideration. And contemplation, that you let the sky determine you. That's contemplation. And therefore, it is a much more universal thing. The word orientation, I'm sure in the next 20 years will have to be replaced by something stronger. Perhaps you think, help us thinking it up. We must become clear, gentlemen, that the influences of a cosmic dimension, influences, you see, are there. We do depend on the sunlight. You know that without ultraviolet rays, we just wither. Children need them. If you let them live behind the ordinary window glass, you see, they wither. They have to get out into the sun because our window glass, as you know, does not allow the ultraviolet rays to get through. Now that's very harmful, because we live by such influences. Perhaps you will note down the word influence as the most universal word which we still use to admit the flux, the influx of cosmic range. When the parliamentarians of the 17th century in England used the word influence, they meant that the members of parliament were influenced by the divine right of kings a little bit, and that these were bad, evil, celestial influences of a higher world, of a higher world. They use the word influence strictly from astronomy, astrology too. And the word influence is a good study for you. We have another word, conjuncture, you see, which was formerly used for boom, you know, and burst, as you know. The word depression, the word opposition, these are all astronomical terms taken down to Earth. Opposition means a star in opposition to another star. Constellation is a word which will come into use in the sciences very much more. In chemistry, you cannot get through just with a compound or composition or combination, or mixture. In biology, the leading biologists, they are ahead, of course, of the mass of their contemporaries. I don't think you will hear anything about this in Dartmouth College. Know that even the elements have to constellate. That is, that something that is true at 9:15 is not true at 9:30. A constellation, gentlemen, is a configuration of elements which pays heed to the time element. The ordinary chemistry is very primitive. It mixes something and says, once this, always this. But when you get into life, gentlemen, time is of the essence. And gentlemen, all time processes are subject to constellation. You could have armed Germany 2 years ago. You can't arm her today. That's over. Only people in the State Department who have gone to a liberal arts college in this college and only live by dead matter can think that you can do something anytime you please. You cannot. Europe could have been saved in 1939, when we had, if we had a division then on the soil of France, as Mr. Mollet, Guy Mollet, said in his great speech in the French chamber a fortnight ago. You know, when they had the decisive vote, the socialist leader got up and said, I vote for this treaty, because if the Americans had only been good enough to have one division in 1939 in Europe, there would have been no World War II. This country is a democracy. Democracy cannot have foreign policy except too late. It's impossible for democracy to be on time. And therefore, this country always comes when the victim is destroyed. Europe was destroyed, then you came, we came to their rescue and sent food parcels. Charity is not a very good idea, gentlemen. First make a man a beggar and then send him food parcels. That's the American policy, and you think that's just God given. You believe that this must be so, you see. That the world has to be destroyed because America comes first. The French didn't say anything worse, gentlemen. Clemenceau said, humanity is nice, but France is better. And the same way you say democracy is the world is nice, but democracy is better. But it means just what I said, that you consider yourself the select group on this earth. There is no solidarity with the rest of the human race, except by charity. And the Russians, of course, have this great gospel that they said there is no salvation except for all. And that is today a great difference in conviction, gentlemen. You live again in a temple state, and with a very bad conscience, and with an attempt to free trade program, at bottom, gentlemen, you still think that the rest of the world lives by handouts, and that we are alone. And that's exactly what the Maya people believe in, the Egyptians, and they believe more successfully in it. You know, the Maya culture lasted 400 years. Now, you don't believe yourself that isolationism in this country with charity for the underprivileged countries will last 400 years from now. I mean, you know already that this is, at best, we are given a time of grace of 75 years in which you can go on like that. After 75 years, transport and everything will have been so quickened that it's just impossible to have one system which is utterly aloof and irresponsible to the rest of the world. You just can't. It's impossible. We are in one world. We may like it or not. It's not our free choosing anymore. So, gentlemen, these last remnants of the temple state, I think, which the Capitol and the White House in Washington represent, they are very beautiful. And I love to be an Egyptian, to tell you the truth. It's a much more convenient living. The prosperity of Egypt was paramount compared to the environment. And the Maya people were tremendous, you see. But the rest of the world just encroached on them and said, we can't have this island. And the downfall of all the civilizations, gentlemen, has always been that the temple was too small. Any one attempt, gentlemen, to let the heavens be reflected in one part of the globe, instead of on the whole globe, breaks down. The attempt to have the Acropolis in Athens or the pyramids of Luxor of Cairo concentrates, you see, the divine favor is impossible. The rest of the world comes. The tragedy, gentlemen, of all the calendar religions we know of has been that they were overrun by wild hordes of men. You go now to Egypt and you find only the Fellahim and no pharaohs. And that's the misfortune of this country. For the last 2,000 years, the Egyptians have not recovered from the beauty of their pharaonic empire. They have been ruled by foreigners since 900 BC. That is, after they had achieved this greatness, you see, this concentration of cosmic insight and reverence, they could not cope with the outside world around them. They had no solidarity with the people around them. Gentlemen, settlement is always separationist. South Carolina is a good example. Secession. Any such group of men secedes. It's very tempting. And they can always say, but we saved something for humanity that is so fine, like southern gentry, that we must preserve it. And he won't mix with us. And if you listen to Mr. Perlman, she's the last echo of this bill. It is better to have our order in one little corner of the globe, you see, than to have anarchy and disorder
all over the world. The same support from Mr. Malan, I said, in South Africa, you see. It's better to have at one place the right order, you see, than to have no order. But you remember, they're all over the globe. They have always appointed them. And I think we must resist the Unitarian efforts of global tribalism, which is threatening us, as long as we haven't forced the rest of the world to adopt the best which we have to offer. There's a, you'll be in, at this moment, there is an American religion, gentlemen, and there is an anti-American religion. The anti-American religion says, all the people. And we say, all the good qualities of the heavens in this one country. You call it prosperity, standard of living. However you call it, these are all things which mean we have achieved a way of the best, of the fullest, you see, of the abundant life. We cannot give up this standard of living, you see, this abundance, just for the sake of embracing, you see, the most remote Eskimo. There's a conflict. And you better admit, gentlemen, all religions have, since they worship one other aspect of the divine majesty, are right and therefore must battle. All decent wars are religious wars, gentlemen. And you have been brought up in this absolutely absurd idea that religious wars are bad wars and the other wars are reasonable. Gentlemen, a war over Alaska, a war about $1 million is unreasonable. A war about God is not unreasonable. Absolutely not. All wars are holy wars, or they are not to be fought. If you would only learn this from this course, gentlemen, then I would have freed you from the worst superstition of the last 100 years. Why have our wars become so tyrannical and so cruel? Because you do not admit that the other man has also a faith which he has arrived at them, and that God's battle. And he do. This is much more dignified. Men can only sacrifice his life for a higher life, and we call all higher lives than our own life divine. How can you give your life for something that is bigger than you, my dear man? Could the $10 million in the bank be bigger than you? They are below you. So you cannot ever go to war for economic reasons. That's scandalous. And this has been the absurd gospel of the last 50 years in this country. I have a colleague in this country, who wrote a book, How to Run a War. It's a crime.
Who knows the book? Does anybody know it? Where are you still teaching?
He thought that the war was the business of a munition maker. Ammunition maker. Gentlemen, don't believe this for me. This is just too absurd. They, of course, get rich, like all the crowds on the battlefield, the ravens, you see, their corpses. The hyena of the battlefield is there. But will you say that the hyena makes the battlefield? Gentlemen, this is very important, because you see at this point the immediate influence of your religion on your political behavior. The United States at this moment are exposed to the decision whether, in defending our order, we should go to war with Russia. Obviously we cannot, because we don't even know what order we defend. There, and certainly we don't know. Nobody knows it.
So preventive war is always a means of despair. So we probably won't go to war. I can say, tell you, we won't go to war, because the religious issue isn't clear. Now, what do we have to offer the rest of the world? We have the 4.4 program, that is very short-breathed and certainly not supported by the majority of the American people. And it is very, what is it? It's crutches, but it's not a vision. And this is, however, asked from you and me, gentlemen. If you cannot believe in the temple state of Washington so fully that you say that the whole globe can come under this aura, this new aura which our dollar notes proclaim. You know what that they proclaim a new aura? You have a dollar note? You know what's on it? Do you know that the word new order is on it? You don't even know it. Take it out.
The dollar, the United States of America, were founded as a temple state. And there's a crown, there's a ray of the sun on it.
the eye of God that is meant to be. And when I say orito, all those say gloro. Huh? Novus oro, yes. We have proclaimed the universal, you see, claim. Very dangerous now. Because few of you could say what it is. Can you formulate? That's what is the limitless today at this moment of our country. We have a hard time to define what is meant by our God. Novus oro, sacrum. Of the eons. Sacrum, gentlemen, is a Latin expression for the Greek eon. It means a period of time in which the stars appear in the same order. And the influences are the same. That's the eon, that's the sacrum. Very important, it's nothing mechanic, but it is the influence, what we call it is a time, it's the spirit of one time, spirit of the Renaissance, the spirit, you see, of the 19th century. That the old people tried to express with the word sacrum. The Etruscans, for example, had 9 sacula in their history. They said that every 120 years. No, there was the sacrum. Well, they said this was more interesting. They had a funny, when two men met, you take a man who lives to be 100. And how was it? The youngest person, the oldest person at any one time. Back to the birthday of the oldest and forward to the death of the youngest would form a sacrum. That was their way of reconciling the animated, you see, and the sort of the astronomical. Very strange idea of the kind of combination of the two worldviews. They call this a sacrum. But otherwise, eon is a very important measure. I want to call a book which I'm writing on these problems The Eon of Society. Meaning to say that the future will only be interested in the great society as we enter the new eon. The 19th century was only interested in nations. Now they are, Costa Rica is not interesting today. Even not to the Costa Ricans. Well, it isn't. Because everything depends on something else, doesn't it? On the American consul in Costa Rica, usually. And whereas the 19th century would have said, you see, this is the eon of the nations, obviously, are the nations, so the eon which we enter today is the eon of the society. Now, gentlemen, the important thing about the eon is it's beyond you and me, my control. Which time you are born into, which century, which eon, you see, you must be able to sympathize. Oh, I'm sorry, I've kept you too long. Let me just finish this one sentence. The importance of the insight into the eons, which these Maya steles try to convey, is that although you and I live in the 20th century, you can know of the influences of the eons.